Go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. This is a meeting of the Investment Committee of the Milwaukee Employees Retirement System. Today is Thursday, December 7th, 2023. The time is now 9:01 a.m. Roll call, please, Jen.
Mr. Bell?
Here.
Ms. Ford?
Here.
Mr. Helling?
Here.
Ms. King? Not present as yet. Mr. Conrad?
Here.
Thank you. Mr. Kovac? Not present as yet. Ms. Sawa?
Here.
Mr. Klusman?
Here.
Quorum?
Mr. Kovac's excused. He anticipates coming.
Okay.
The number ending in 17, is that you, Mr. Conrad?
Yes, I just had trouble. I'm pretty far away. I had a phone in to get through. I'm here.
Fantastic.
Tom, before we start, could I have a note to mention the trustees? One of our long-serving trustees passed away on November 25th. Tom Hayes, former deputy city attorney, passed away just after Thanksgiving on the 25th. And Tom started with the city back in 1966, and I believe he retired in 2002. And, he was chair of the deferred comp board as well, and he was on this board. I thought for a long time when I got here in 2008, he was still an active employee because I talked to him about it every day, you know, and we'd see him at all the deferred comp meetings too. So he's going to be missed. There's no question.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I see we have some closed session possibly. Do you think we need to do that?
I think we do. Yeah.
Okay. Item for item one, please be advised that the investment committee may vote to convene in closed session on the following item one, as provided in section 19.85 sub 1 sub E of the Wisconsin state statutes, to deliberate or negotiate the purchasing of public properties, the investing of public funds, or conducting other specified public business whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session. The investment committee may then vote to reconvene an open session following the closed session. Is there a motion to go into closed session?
This is Aicha. I'll make the motion.
Thank you, Aicha. Second?
Helling, no second.
Thank you, Mr. Helling. Roll call, please.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Ms. King, not present as yet. Mr. Conrad?
Aye.
Ms. Sawa?
Aye.
Mr. Klusman?
Aye.
Quorum and the time, please, and I'll pause.
Time is 9:04 a.m.
Thanks.
And Terry, what is 11? We're back in open session. Still, sorry. Forgot.
Right,
We're back in open session. We're still on item one. Do I have a motion relative to item one? I'll make a motion for approval of the Abbott Capital Private Equity Investor 2024 LP side letter. Someone spoke up there, possibly with a second.
Conrad, second.
Thank you, Mr. Conrad. Anyone opposed? Hearing none, that matter is approved. We'll move on to item number two, which is approval of the Loomis sales guideline change. Eric?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. In your packet, you have a red line of Loomis sales guidelines. So this is a continuation of what we worked on the last meeting. You'll remember we approved a bunch of new guidelines, and there was just one that got held over, which was the 144A securities. So Terry, you can go to the second page of this actually. So really, you can see the only red line here is changing that 144A amount from 50 to 65%. And that's, Callan worked with Loomis on that. I'll turn it over to Callan to talk about that. I don't know, is David Z here?
I don't think so. Okay. So I can just briefly go over, I think David has been working with the folks at Loomis going back and forth, and I think they originally asked for 100% limit, which...
Not to cut you off, Jan.
Oh, this is Mike Jakin from Callan.
Thanks.
They had initially asked for 100%. That seemed imprudent, full 100% to allow that. And so we went back and forth, and you know, they provided some analysis. David Z went back and forth with them, who is the head of our fixed income research. And I think they settled on a 65% limit. And I think really the crux of that is, you know, even when they initially asked for 100%, you know, they helped us run some models and we looked at some analysis. At 100%, they would be above the sort of the guidelines in terms of the overall portfolio's quality. And so I think that was the crux of 65 is enough, where they can go up to 65 and it won't blow through the overall portfolio's credit quality. And also I think 65 is practically plenty where we should not have to revisit this anytime in the near future.
Wonderful. Yeah, staff is supportive. Like Eric's mentioned, I mean, I give Cal and Ann Loomis a lot of credit for finding a number that they're both very happy with. Loomis has been asking to raising this for a long time, and they asked when we brought this to you a month ago, along with their other list of things to approve. It asked for 100. David Z did talk to you last month. We all agreed to approve everything except for this last month. And I give Cal and Loomis credit for getting us to a spot where everybody's happy. And like Mike said, we shouldn't be talking about this for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Great. Any questions? Comments? Motions for approval or not?
Conrad moves approval.
Thank you, Mr. Ford.
Seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Conrad and Ms. Ford. Anyone opposed? Hearing none, item two is approved. Moving on to item three, approval of the statement of investment policy update. David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Hopefully everybody received in their packet, had a chance to read my brief memo on this proposal here. There's a few pages where the red line was provided to you so you can visualize what you're actually asked to consider approving. And then I think the last three pages were the clean versions. You know, I mean, I don't want to go, just rehash what's in the memo, but I'm happy to answer any questions about it. I think at a high level, our guidelines currently say we, under no circumstances, unless we ask for an exception from the board, we don't have the flexibility to have more than 2% of the fund's assets in what we call the Milwaukee Cash custodial account. We're about a $5.5 billion fund roughly right now, so $110 million, give or take. We've always had some challenges that we've navigated at the end of the year, early in January, when we get a large, one big contribution from the city and agencies early in the year. Starting in about a month from now, we expect getting as much as $200 million in one day. And that obviously is much more than 2%, I don't have any flexibility currently from the guidelines other than to take the money now, the day we get it, and try to work with the team here and the investment managers and the custodian to get it deployed to investment managers on the same day as quickly as I can. So what's being proposed, I mean, I guess one other thing I'll say is, you know, at a high level, depending on where our fund's at, how it's performed, where interest rates are, you know, sometimes it's more important to rebalance with big contributions, and sometimes, frankly, it's probably in the fund's interest to take that money and set it aside in a cash account and use it to just pay benefits over the next few months. And from year to year, that can change, let alone from quarter to quarter. We've spent a lot of time because of the asset allocation change we made this summer, already rebalancing a lot of the portfolio. So we're not significantly out of balance in terms of our stock and bond portfolios right now. We're pretty close to where we want to be. So if nothing changes in the markets over the next month, all else equal, when we receive $200 million in early January, I am currently leaning towards setting aside the majority of that for, you know, keeping in cash and paying the benefits for it. I just don't have the flexibility to do that right now. I think I mentioned that, you know, our cash account at Northern Trust is invested all in short-term governments. That's pretty linked to the Fed funds rate, and the Fed funds rate is currently over 5%. So that's an annualized yield, but you're not giving up much of an opportunity cost there when you have a little over 5% yield in your cash account and you're trying to get a 6.8% discount rate. And at the same time, you can incur transaction costs, market uncertainty and volatility. If I had to work within the current rules of the guidelines, it's say I have to take the money invested in stocks and bonds and then sell it a month or two later to pay the benefits. So I'm looking for the flexibility. I don't want to pin myself down and promise that, okay, I'm definitely going to do something in January, because the stock market could go down a lot at the end of the year, and then maybe rebalancing into stocks becomes more important than putting the money in cash. The flip side can occur too, and hopefully that happens, right? Maybe stocks will have another historic month, and we get to the point where it's like, okay, well, we're underweight bonds. I'd rather take more of that $200 million and invest it in bonds and sell some stocks in January and February to pay benefits. But I'd like to have that flexibility, and that's what I'm asking you for permission for, what these changes would allow me to do. So I guess, Terry, I'm going to ask you to bounce around a little bit, but if you went to page 5 of 8 here, I'm going to start maybe here and go backwards. The problem that I'm asking to be solved, perfect, right there. So go up a little bit so we can see. So you'll see under fixed income we have cash, and we're redlining the 2%, and I'm asking to consider replacing that with 5%. I mean, this isn't going to be used as a tactical thing. I'm not going to decide in the middle of the year, oh, we should have 5% cash or not. This is okay, you know, we might have a cash balance at the end of the year. You add $200 million to it. That could push a 4%, 5%. It could push a 4% limit. 5% should be plenty, should be sufficient. And that helps me with this scenario where, okay, if the appropriate thing seemed, if we're good from a rebalancing standpoint and we want to have the money in cash, I'd be able to keep it in cash, not make immediate actions in January, and I'd have 3 or 4 months worth of benefits to pay from it. Let's go backwards now. Go one more slide. Yeah, this one's the one. And let's look at D&E together. So these two pages, they can look maybe intimidating with some of the red lines here, but they're really just trying to say the same thing. E talks about, we tried to update E to more accurately explain the flexibility that's taken into account when we receive contributions and redeploy it. So when we talk about staff has discretion whether to do rebalancing or to put it in cash or some combination of you know, I know we talked about 2022 a lot, where it was a very challenging environment and stocks were down a lot, bonds were down a lot. But I still had to pick. We had to incorporate a liquidity management kind of framework to pay benefits from. It wasn't just strictly based on targets. So I'm referencing that. And then I'm also referencing just our general ALM studies. So, you know, everything, it's kind of, that's to provide assurance really to you that, you know, I'm taking actions in the spirit of the risk and return targets that our fund identifies and approves whenever we do a strategic asset liability study. Again, I'm going backwards, I apologize for that, but D is the flip side. It's not the times when we receive the contributions and have to decide what to do with the money. D is the flip side of that. Okay, we don't have the money in cash. I need to raise money to pay the $40, $45 million in benefits, and also if we get calls and things like that from private equity. So that's really just explaining the flip side of it. Again, staff retains discretion. These are things that are taken into account, the risk and return characteristics of our asset allocations from the ALM studies, things like that. So, and then if you want to just go down to F, there's a few red lines there. I think this is stuff we frankly are already kind of doing, but I just figured it'd be nice to maybe more clearly state it. I mean, when we did the ALM study this summer, that's expected to be implemented. So there were a few months where we implemented that, but it wasn't necessarily clearly, I thought that F was an appropriate place, or that restructure, that bullet point at the top with the restructuring. It just makes it clear that these are the things we're thinking about, we've taken into consideration, and they're now clearly identified in the strategic in the statement of investment policy. So hopefully that made sense. That's what you're here to consider today, I guess. That's what these changes would allow us to do and the thought process behind it. And I'm happy to take any questions. If anything I said is confusing or you think there's a better way anything you're uncomfortable with, I guess.
Great. Thank you, David. And well, to kick off the discussion, I guess I would add that I think it's wonderful that you're doing this, that you're thinking, you're looking down the road and you're looking to have the ability to make the best decisions that you possibly can without having all kinds of archaic, hamstrung guidelines that would impede you from doing what's best and using your and your team's talents to do what obviously, and again, is best for the fund. So I think this is just fantastic. And then secondly, if Terry, could you go back to David's letter? No. I'm just gonna pipe here because I tend to run off down a little bit. The first sentence of the second paragraph, I really was floored when I read that, and down some more, up some more. A lot of funds in the world would kill to read that statement that they got $200 million a year coming in for the foreseeable future, and us ourselves, it wasn't that long ago that we were sitting here lamenting, grinding, chewing our fingers, wondering how funding was going to come, and to read that is just, you know, a fantastic thing in recollection of what we've been through and things. So that's great, but it's even better that you're going to make good use of it and things. So those are my points that I came up with reading this. Anyone else have questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Conrad, great. I was hoping you'd speak up. I was going to call you, but I was going to point you out, but I didn't want to be mean. I was hoping you'd weigh in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a very good idea. And will provide a little more stability for the fund. And if they're willing to pay an annualized return of 5.4%, we would have been really thrilled to get that several years ago. So I think it's important too, if large amounts of money come in and you can commit, set it aside to pay future benefits, or at least I should say, not far distant future, but the ones that will be payable in the near future, that protects you if there's some event or downturn in a market, so you don't have to sell at that point. So, they used to say cash is trash. Well, not trash anymore. So,
yeah. So, Mr. Chairman, this is Jerry.
Jerry,
I just want to make a point for the trustees that, as you all know, we're moving into a new environment here. Our plan is being closed at the end of this year. And this won't happen right away, but, you know, over time, liquidity will be more and more important to this plan. And having, giving our investment staff the flexibility to optimize the use of cash will be increasingly important as years go by. Like I said, it's, I don't expect this to set in the first 5 years, but down the road, as, you know, employee contributions aren't going to be coming in anymore from new hires, and the amount of the benefit payments is going to continue to increase. Hopefully our assets will increase too. But there is market volatility, as we all know, and there will be times when we will be very glad to have our investment team optimize the use of cash when the contributions come in at the end of the year. I'm pretty sure David and Eric are not talking about market timing, and of course the board of trustees will, and myself will be there to make sure that this doesn't happen on our watch and on David's watch. So I would just wanted to mention I would fully support this idea as being a prudent use of talent here to optimize our situation as we move into a new environment. Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
Fantastic. Anyone else? All right. Can we get a motion then for this item?
I will make the motion.
Motion for
approval. Rachel will second.
Okay.
Rachel will second.
Mr. Bell, was that Mr. Bell or Mr. Helling?
Bell.
Mr. Bell made a motion for approval, and yep. Aicha made a second. Anyone opposed? Yep. Hearing none, that item is approved. Now we go back.
Before we start an open session, we are going to go into closed session. Now we'll give you the cue. We'll do that.
Okay, so we're going to kick off item four in open session, and then at some point, Mike will probably tell us when to go into closed session.
I think Mooney will handle that.
He's in it. Okay. So item four is the Callen Real Estate presentation, and Mooney is out there.
Yeah, actually, this is Sally. If you don't mind, I'm going to start it off, and then we'll pass it over to Munir. Hi, everybody. Happy, can you hear me? Happy holidays.
Yes.
Great. So we have this deck set up to talk a little bit about the market and then about your portfolio. So if you want to go forward two slides, I think. There we go. Go to the next one, please. Yep. So what I tried to do here is on the left-hand side, layout, back one, please, is to lay out some of the broader themes that are impacting, well, really our lives on a day-to-day basis, but in a real way impacting how we're investing your portfolio. So that's sort of outlined in the market environment, you know, what is happening with regard to each of these themes, and then what does that impact in terms of strategies that are important, that's in the hot line, and then strategies that we do not like in each environment. So I think it's reasonably straightforward, and but you know, the number one thing on the top is higher interest rates. So as we go to the next slide, you can see that that is impacting valuations. Slide five, please. Valuations in the real estate market, and we're still in a repricing environment with depreciation, which started around last year at this time. So go to the next slide, please. And really, this shows returns by property types. Really, all property types have been impacted in the most recent one-year period, except for hotels, which were already really marked down. So they actually are doing reasonably well. But if you want to go over to that 15-year column, the other thing I wanted to point out is that, you know, office and retail haven't been doing well for a long time. This isn't, you know, the most recent phenomenon. And that's why, really, since we started to take your portfolio over, we've been trying to move away from those property types. So Next slide, please. We have a big problem in the debt market. As you know, real estate is leveraged, and we have a lot of loans that are coming due in the next several years. And the problem is that they were made when pricing was very rich. Buyers or owners of real estate got a lot of proceeds at very low rates, and now they have to refinance, and say their rate was 3 or 4, it is now 6 to 8%. So that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So we think that, and a lot of lenders have pulled back. So we think that there's an opportunity for private capital. Somebody's going to have to come in and provide the debt financing for these properties. And so that certainly weighs on pricing if you cannot get debt. Next slide, please. Sort of the good news is in all of this that the fundamentals, vacancy rates are shown on the bottom, but fundamentals are pretty good so far, except for office. So that's good, and we'll see as we go forward that there is positive operating income growth. But like I said, the pricing is really all backward at this point. On the top, the cap rates give you an indication of sort of the yield of real estate. And if you consider that the 10-year is at about 4, and the spread of real estate to 10-year treasuries is typically around 360 basis points, you know, you can see at 4 or 5 that real estate should be priced at, you know, more a 7 to an 8 for sure, rather than the 4 to 5 or so that's on there. So we have a ways to go in terms of depreciation, we think, to get to those numbers. Next slide, please. And this is the revenue growth that I wanted to point out to you. Very positive numbers here. And so you can mitigate some of the valuation decline if you have rising income. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is, if you looked on the left-hand side of the chart, you will see that a lot of the higher rental growth is in alternative property types. And that's one of the reasons that we recommended the fund that you're in. And also, a lot of your existing funds do have a share of some of these property types. So we continue to like some of the alternatives, like cold storage, and industrial isn't really an alternative, but that's still a good sector to be in, and you've got a dedicated industrial fund. And then on the next slide, I thought this was a really interesting one because it sort of also supports this idea about why do we like some of the alternative sectors. And we see on the left-hand side, you see for property types, which ones are more linked to GDP. And changes in GDP, and you can see enclosed malls and office move up and down more than self-storage and student housing and manufactured housing as GDP changes. So obviously we think you should have a mix in your portfolio, but the stuff that is not as GDP linked is less variable, we think. And then also, you do not have to reserve as much money to keep those properties up. That's on the right-hand side. It shows capital expenditures that you have to reserve. This is for things like if a tenant moves out, if you need to put new floors in, new windows, you know, landscaping, if you need to redo the space. And, you know, malls and office spaces and even some of the retail just require a lot of money to upkeep. And you don't always get paid back for that money. So if you can stick at the lower CapEx property types, it's easier to make money over time. Next slide, please. And this is just a reminder, you know, you will have money going into the market with the fund that you approved but we just wanted to remind you that we're going to try to pace that money in, but you don't really need to call the bottom of the market when you put your money in sort of times of crises. Like, so on the right-hand side, this shows the three real estate crises, the early 90s, the tech crash, and then the financial crisis. And you can see what the five-year return was if you look at the trough. If you put your money in the trough periods for all that time, all those time frames, you can see in the orange box what the return, the five-year return would have been. But what I also want you to notice is if you put it in two quarters earlier or two quarters later, that the return was actually, the returns were actually very strong. So this is why we like, this is why we like pacing. So that's it on the market overview, and I'm going to turn it over to Munir to talk about your portfolio. Thanks.
Mike, those are cumulative numbers.
Hi, everyone. Yep. Thank you, Terry. Hi, this is Sally. That's good to be with you all. If you go to the next slide, please, Terry. Thanks. And the subsequent slide there. So just as a reminder, the purpose of real estate within CMER's portfolio is continue to get that lower volatility, that return between stocks and bonds, enhanced diversification, and then it's benchmarked to open-end diversified core index. That constituent is 25 U.S.-focused core real estate funds. Another thing I'd note is in 2022, the real estate allocation was increased to 9.7%. Next slide, we can talk a bit more about the portfolio and in summary. So, you know, as percentage of plan assets, as of 2Q, real estate exposure is approximately $500 million, and that's just about 8.8%. When you include unfunded commitments, which includes the new fund to be called 2024, that rises to 9.9%, just a hair underneath under 10%. And if that includes the diversified real assets fund and unfunded commitments, you're just under 13%, which is within the range of the guidelines of 10 to 16% allocation. Core real estate continues to make a broader proportion of the portfolio, which is the goal. The wind down is continuing with the non-core. And, you know, just highlighting the capital that's to be called, is you have about that $50 million to be called for a new investment, and then there's about $2 million that's likely to be called from the non-core portfolio. But again, it continues to make a shrinking proportion of the portfolio. Well, next slide, we'll highlight, again, the portfolio repositioning is largely complete. If you look at where the progress we've done in the past 6 years, non-core funds were 22%, now they're down to 2%. So, core is becoming the main driver in the portfolio, starting to wind down some of those delayed investments. So the non-core funds, as a reminder, some of them were delayed because the liquidation was during the pandemic, which has delayed a lot of some of those wind downs because of the stalled transaction markets. And within the non-core portfolio, majority of the capital is within one fund, which expects to wind down in subsequent year. Enter your attendee
ID number, followed by pound. Sorry, could you hold on 1 second, please? I'd lost the public line.
Sure. Okay, no problem.
Your entry 25523386709 is not valid. Enter your attendee ID number.
We just have a technological thing going on here, so just Trying to fix it internally to make sure the public can hear.
Go ahead now, please.
Yes, thank you, Terry. And the last thing I'd highlight on this page is many of the individual funds that were redeemed from in 2017 had overweights to office, so this was an intentional decision to lean into those sectors with tailwinds. So on the next slide, you can look at the portfolio allocation. So we changed the format a bit on this page just so we can kind of see the office exposure and kind of see the progress that's been done. If you look at the bottom right, you can see the exposure of office. So office will continue to be a shrinking proportion of this portfolio, at least traditional office, for three main reasons. One is that all the managers are looking to reduce exposure to office. That will occur through dispositions. Secondly, depreciation. There are fundamentals that are continuing to erode within office. And then lastly, we're allocating to sectors to the new core fund, which has exposure to alternatives. So that bottom right, you can see about 50% is in what's called central business district office, and that is in kind of major centers or hubs, which is suffering the most. But if you'll notice, about 24% of that is in the alternative types of office, which have tailwinds, so that life science, medical office. And so if you look at the broader portfolio positioning, multifamily is slight underweight, and that tends to be a sector that is defensive in nature. But one thing I'd highlight is that other section of 3% includes alternative exposures to housing, which tend to be single-family rentals, SFR. And the largest age cohort millennials are in family formation years. Need for homes is greater and greater, especially with the current cost of mortgage rates. So that 3% includes an alternative housing. Industrial continues to be an overweight, and there's still lots of tailwinds in the sector. We've reduced that with staff manage the guidelines within the IPS. And then retail is about equal weight. Grocery and retail continue to perform. And then if we're looking at the alternatives, self-storage and healthcare, that'll continue to be a larger proportion of the portfolio as we target allocation in those sectors.
I have a question on this. Next slide. Munir?
Yeah.
So for the new manager that we're funding up, next year, would things like life sciences and medical office and that new manager be show up as office, and or would it show up in like other? Would it be a surprise if we had an overweight to office at this point next year? And I guess you would, if the answer is yes, that's why this is important, right? We wouldn't want to be alarmed tell us what to expect, how it might look next year.
Sure. That's a good point that you're hitting on, because within the index, the Odyssey Index, which you're benchmarked to, which consists of 25 core real estate focused funds with lower leverage focused on the current income yield, there's a greater discussion as far as these alternative sectors are functionally no longer alternative. These are becoming kind of the future and existing core of real estate. So some managers do include it within office. If that is the case with this new relationship, we will highlight and break it out and say this percentage is traditional office, this percentage is life sciences and medical office.
So it's almost, it's not clear, I guess, that sometimes the managers, there's some discretion for the managers how they report it then, is what you're saying. So it's a little to be determined. Is that why there's like 9% in Odyssey benchmark other? Is it just some managers prefer to, is it clear to you, like to you and Sally, like what that is and why that maybe has grown over the last couple of years?
So other has increased, mm-hmm, because that includes everything from land, cash, alternative types of housing, whether senior housing, single family rental. So we request the data on a quarterly basis. We break out traditional office, life sciences, medical office. And so we will disaggregate it if that's the way it's returned to us, especially for that bottom right pie chart. We ask specifically to break out their office composition so we can represent it as such. We think it's easier to see and easier to digest that way.
Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate it.
On the next slide, we can see how the allocations have reflected in performance. So as Sally touched on, you can see the repricing occurring in the one-year number, particularly with appreciation, as we're continuing to see valuations reflect current borrowing costs. Over the longer term, midterm and current term, the portfolio has outperformed. It's our belief that the past cycle was driven by appreciation. The capital was cheap. There's lots of accretive pricing. We think going forward with a higher for longer environment, that majority of return will be at historical norms driven by income. The next slide, we break out core, non-core versus the benchmark. What I highlight again is that non-core is about 2% of the portfolio, outperformed over the past year, but that's a rather de minimis amount. Core continues to anchor the portfolio, continues to outperform on the shorter, mid, and long term. Again, we're seeing that repricing occurring, but because of the sectors that your managers are invested in, they continue to outperform in a repricing environment. Let me go to the conclusions, Terry. So next two slides there. So, in closing, Portfolio continues to perform well over the mid, short, mid, and long term. Core continues to drive performance. We like where the allocations are currently. They will continue to be veered toward those alternative sectors with the new allocation, but also because your managers are enriching the portfolios from low ROX exposure to those with greater return, risk-adjusted returns. And, we're continuing to rebalance the portfolio with that new relationship, with that new core fund. We've been monitoring prior sessions, the weight of Morgan Stanley Prime, getting closer to the guideline with the new relationship. That won't be a concern. Our recommendations are twofold. One is to continue to monitor developments between the J.P. Morgan Strategic Property Fund, given the discussion at the prior meeting, and then the next item, our focus will be on funding the new manager in 2024. So I'll pause there for questions.
Questions?
This is Conrad.
Mr. Conrad?
Looking at that last 10 years chart on performance, but we've had 10 years of low interest rates and non-inflationary environment. Could you look back further sometime to kind of look at a period more similar to what we probably can expect for the next few years to see how they perform that environment, that is, the environment of higher interest rates and higher rents?
Yeah, I think historically, past the last 10 years, core real estate has returned roughly 6 to 8%, majority of that from income, as you touched on. And, as we lean into these higher yielding sectors, it's a balance between shorter leases, which are the multifamily sectors, self storage as well. The new investment is a balanced portfolio of self storage, multifamily, and then longer term leases. The shorter term leases are able to more quickly reflect inflation and rising rates as well. And we believe that'll continue to be a benefit for the portfolio in the longer term.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I was just going to add on slide 7. Slide 17, Terry. On the chart on the bottom left, income returns versus benchmark. I was excited to see that income is starting to outperform the Odyssey, which I think we've been in this weird situation the last 5 years where income's been we always want the stability of income, and we always believe that we're setting up the real estate portfolio for income to be a meaningful component to the long-term return. But because of our overweight to industrial, we had just incredible appreciation in that sector. Is the right place to be at the right time. And so, I mean, we didn't want to complain with these top quartile type real estate returns, but they were coming from appreciation, not income. So we have consciously, I mean, the last year and a half, just tried to make sure our real estate portfolio maintains the spirit of the diversification and that we want. And part of that means trying to emphasize getting that income number up. And I mean, we can't make big conclusions off of 12 months, and we haven't even funded the new manager yet, which should have a big income component too. But I was excited to at least see signs that the income is becoming more meaningful. So, are there any more questions? Otherwise, we'll go into closed session if there are no more questions. So.
Any other questions? All right, hearing none, then we'll go into the closed session portion of this. So please be advised that the investment committee may vote to convene in closed session on the following item 4, as provided in section 19.85 sub 1 sub e of the Wisconsin State Statutes, to deliberate or negotiate the purchasing of public properties, the investing of public funds, or conducting other specified public business whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session. The investment committee may then vote to convene in open session following the closed session. Is there a motion to go into closed session?
Bell will motion.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
A second. Helling,
Mr. Helling, thank you for a second. Roll call, please, Jen.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Ms. King? Not present as yet. Mr. Conrad?
Aye.
Ms. Sawa?
Aye.
Mr. Klusman?
Aye.
Quorum and the time, please. I'll pause the recorder.
9:55, 10:07 a.m. And we're back in open session. And Munir and Sally, thank you for coming out and educating us.
Thank you all. Good to be with you.
So we're on item 5 now, which is the, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you, Gary. We're on item 5, which is this Q2 2022 private equity summary. David?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief with my comments, but this is often something you'll see in a quarterly package. We hadn't received all the data to get it into what we presented to you in November, but we still like to get it in front of you. Again, private equity comes to us at a lag, so we'll, in the next few weeks, or probably in the next 4 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, we'll expect to be getting September 30th marks from private equity. We haven't got any yet, have we, Eric? So, but we're definitely interested to see what it is. So this is all the June 30 snapshot. I'll just walk through. I think the big takeaway is, you know, performance. You have a list of all the partnerships that we've actually invested capital into here. There's maybe a couple that as of June 30th had investments in it. So the real committed capital is a higher number, but as of June 30th, we hadn't invested in the other ones, so they don't make it on this list yet. But again, performance, it's kind of flatlined the last couple quarters. Just, I mean, that's how the private equity market has been, but the drawdown that we might have seen that was associated with the stock market pullback last year. I mean, it's most of our managers have that hits flown through, it appears. I mean, I think it's still fascinating to see. I mean, again, this summarizes everything that we, since we started doing this asset class in 2010, but I mean, we've invested $767 million. We've actually received $657 million back. So that's a net $110 million invested, and we're still sitting on a value of $775 million on everything else that we've put in. So again, it's where it's the TVPI kind of measures, it's a metric that shows you how, what's the multiple of the value of our investment plus what we've received as a ratio of how much we put in. So a lot of these older funds, they start with a 2 point, and that just means that we've more than doubled our investment, I guess. And the way that private equity works is the stuff that happens in the near term, it takes years to play out. So it can take a few years to get invested. It takes a few years after that for the investment to kind of get to work and to the investment thesis to play out. And then I mean, oftentimes it can be by year 7, 8, 9 before you're actually seeing the big gains when things go well. But that's why you see lower numbers in the ones, I guess, right, for the newer funds. I think vintage year is something that's super important. We don't talk about it all the time, but that chart kind of middle left, you don't want to, private equity in particular, you don't want to put all your money in it at one point in time, because if that 1 year is a bad year, if those 2 years are bad years, then you've pretty much destroyed your portfolio. So again, if we all had crystal balls, we would use them, but again, this is such a long-term investment that, I mean, the best managers typically just try to smooth that out. So you can see, really starting in 2012, 2014, we're consistently in that 60 to 100 million dollar annualized, or annual getting money to work. And it's good to see. You can't be too precise on this stuff, but it's for the way we approach it, I mean, it is indicative of a process that's probably working. I think one thing that was interesting in Q2, you can see this in the very bottom chart on page one, we had the most capital calls in our history of our program in a given quarter in Q2. I mean, I think there's maybe a couple reasons for that. Number one, we did have a couple, and they might be related, to be honest. We activated a couple funds that had used credit lines, but at the same time, if you remember what happened in Q2, this was Silicon Valley Bank. This was kind of, there was for a couple weeks, there is some unsettling news about the banking system, right, and credit lines and how private equity and things like that. So I think, I mean, I mean, this might be a little anecdotal, but yeah, I think credit lines were probably drawn down a bit in during this time period too. So the combination of having some new investments starting in Q2 for us, plus maybe a little bit, maybe it's indicative of a little bit of the banking sector stress and the credit line drawdown. I don't expect us to have a lot more quarters like that to be a new trend. It was most likely a one or two quarter type phenomenon. I think the last takeaway is that we're really diversified in our private equity program, whether it's by year we invest, whether it's by the sectors we invest in, how we invest in. So like we break things out by buyout are kind of the more mature private companies, they're established businesses, they have modest amount of leverage on them, but you know, we pay our managers to have the skill to kind of get us in the best private companies. They're usually more diversified by sector. That makes up about 58% of our private equity program. And then you see kind of the remaining 42% spread out between venture capital, 18% there, that's the higher risk, higher reward stuff. It's truly business creation and the idea phase. Growth equity is kind of the part between venture capital and buyout. These are more than just an idea. These are businesses truly making money, but they're not like established, mature, and like buyout. That's we just started isolating that for the first time, but that's 14%. We included in venture capital before, but I think it's, I know for me it's a little comforting knowing that, you know, we're not showing you an analysis that says we have a third of our private equity exposure in venture capital. We have more visibility into it now. It's really 18% in venture capital, which is the highest risk part, and 14% in that graduation stage above the venture capital. In special situations, it's kind of a catch-all for any niche for private equity. And we're diversified by the second page. I'll show you by the number of managers, partnerships. I mean, we believe we have access and investments in somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 actual private companies. So, I mean, it's a very diversified program, also by primary, secondary, co-investments. You can see sectors and geography. It's almost 80% U.S., which is probably the right place to be for a U.S.-based investor investing in private companies. But we do have a little bit in Western Europe and other places. Just wanted to get this in front of you. We don't always have a chance to spend a lot of time on it. But I was just personally at Apogeum. We have it's called Private Advisors on our on page one of our investments, but they had an annual conference. I learned a lot. I had some great conversations with the CEO there and investment professionals. That's an interesting investment because it wasn't one of the high flyers during the 2016, 17, 18, 19. We talked about that a lot with Cal and with Gary. Eric had great conversations with them on this, and it's one of the managers. It focuses on small buyouts, so it's the smaller private companies. It doesn't do venture capital and stuff like something like that. But you know, they've been one of our steadiest performers in the last couple of years. It really seems like small buyouts. One of the thesis behind small buyouts is there's, you know, I mean, in some respect, being in small companies can be a little riskier than the large mature companies, but at the same time, you know, there's more exit opportunities for the small buyout firms. It's easier to buy and build, it's easier to grow, it's easier to find other companies that maybe they're just willing to buy a smaller company as a way to grow. They're not as reliant on the IPO market for things like that, or they're not playing the games with maybe leverage and debt that some of the larger ones do. So, and we've seen it in the marks the last couple of years, and it was I had a good feeling coming out of the conference. So as well, that I just got back from last night. So that concludes my prepared remarks. I'm happy to,
Mr. Chairman, David, to your point about diversification, as I understand it, a large part of the opportunity set in the equity capital, domestic equity capital markets, is in private equity. You recall, it's been a while since, do you recall what percentage that is? North of 50?
It's a great question. I don't recall. It's been a number of years since I looked, but it's fascinating. I remember being shocked when I looked at this. I mean, it could have been more than 5 years ago, but I mean, the majority of companies in the United States are private. They're not public. I mean, we talk about the companies on the stock market all the time, but the majority of the economy, the majority of the jobs created, the majority of employed people are actually with private companies. So, if you don't invest in this, I mean, it's a tough asset class because it's not transparent, it's not liquid. You're investing in teams that you hope stay together for 15, 20 years and return your money with a return. But if at the same time, if you're not investing in private equity, you're missing out on just a big part of the economy and GDP, and that's one of the advantages we have as an institutional investor is we have the resources to partner with. I mean, I was talking to somebody earlier, so we have three or four layers in when we do this. You hire your staff, that's one layer. You hire a consultant, that's another layer. We then hire a fund-of-funds manager who isn't the actual manager and managing the money. They're the ones that are then charged with having all the resources to invest in the managers that are actually investing in these private companies. So that still doesn't guarantee then you can avoid all the problems with private equity, and it doesn't guarantee you high returns, but we're trying to do this the smartest, safest way while still giving ourselves the ability to get a very attractive return net of fees, and it has played out that way since 2010. I don't know if anybody else to add to that. Thank you for your insight. Any other questions from committee members on private equity or anything we just talked about?
Great. Okay. Hearing none, that wraps up item five. Moving us on to item six, the Chief Investment Officer report.
David. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and again, I'll be brief with my comments. I just want to use this as an opportunity to tell you how the fund's doing. I guess I should start at November. I think it was just, was it last week, our board meeting, last Tuesday? I think we told you we had a 1.8% return year to date through October, and we told you November was it had changed that quite a bit. I wrote down some headline articles I saw. For bonds, the return for bonds in November, just a simple Treasury U.S. ag type benchmark, the return was the highest since the 1980s for a single month. The return for the S&P's only had a return of 8% or more in, this is just for the month of November, but going back, looking at the last 100 years of Novembers, I think it's only, there's only been an 8% return or higher in the month of November over the last 100 years. That's only happened maybe 8-9 times. So it really was like, from a historical perspective, an incredible single month for the markets. And it looks like we're going to end up around 4.9%. That's our best guess right now at the fund level, which is a pretty incredible single month return. We're showing a benchmark of about 5.2%. That underperformance it actually wasn't from our investment managers. Manager selection was fine. Even our public equity portfolio kept up with the benchmark. It actually came a little bit from asset allocation. We were a little underweight stocks going into November. Just think how stocks had gone down in August, September, October. We were underweight a little bit. Being underweight a little bit of something that goes up 8% ends up showing up when you talk about where over outperformance, underperformance shows up. And style bias was a piece of it too. And that's been a theme for the last year, but the whole market did really well, but if you were in the large growth, you did even better. So, and that's, again, we have that access. We talked about that last meeting, but we don't have as much as the benchmarks. And again, that's really responsible for the underperformance. So far in December, the markets are a little more muted. We are positive so far this first week in December. We're showing about 0.4% return, which is keeping up with the benchmark. So as of yesterday, our fund value is right around $5.58 billion. Our year-to-date net of fee return, our estimate right now is about 7.2% year-to-date. And that is underperforming the benchmark by about 2.6%. We've talked about this, so I spent a lot of time on this on the investment committee. I think if you excluded how we compare our private equity returns to our private equity benchmark, if you just excluded that, we'd be pretty much flat for the year. And the other big piece of it is style bias is hurting us, the underweight to technology stocks. The rest of our portfolio has done well enough to offset the style bias piece of it, but the private equity piece I think I showed you the last, if you look at private equity over the last 3, 5, 10 years, we're still outperforming our benchmark handily. It's just the way we do it. We compare private equity to public equity marks. Mm-hmm. The private equity is not reflecting what's going on in public markets at the moment. I mean, we would hope that, you know, the IPO market opens up next year, especially if there's more stability in interest rates and the economy, and if people get more confidence with the stock market rally. I mean, we would expect private equity to open up, but until that happens, we're going to see funny things when we look at private equity on a 12-month time period, things like that. So that was really my prepared remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions about the markets or our fund at this time.
Anything? Okay. Well, it's a great presentation when you don't get questions, because you answer them all.
Thanks. Thank you.
All right. That wraps up item 6, leaving only item 7, which is informational. And we don't really need to cover that. You can do that on your own, which leaves us open for a motion to adjourn.
Bell will make the motion to adjourn.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. A second?
Aicha, second.
Thank you, Aicha. Hearing no, anyone opposed? All right, hearing none, we are stand adjourned at 10:25 a.m. Thank you, everyone.